Alright, so I wanted to begin by adding one very small point to what we discussed last week, namely the idea of what simcha is. We discussed last week what the concept of simcha is, and I just wanted to bring one point, which I just happened to see, which I think fits very nicely with the idea that we developed last week, for the advantage of not having a curriculum, is if we have something to add on, we can just add it on when we come to it. Basically, the idea that we had developed last week was all predicated on the starting point that the idea of simcha is summed up with the Maamar Chazal that ein simcha kehataras hasfikos, that there is no simcha like the simcha of the resolution of a suffik, of doubt. And suggested last week, we tried to build from this, that the concept of simcha is really encapsulated in that. That's not just the happenstance example of the epitome of simcha, but that's really defining what the shoresh, what the root of simcha is. And we started off last week, we explained that the idea of a suffik is the result of the conflicting implications of two possibilities. And we said that the tension created by that, by two options which result in two different outcomes, that's really the shoresh, that's really the root of what a suffik is. A suffik is the conflict between two opposing possibilities that yield conflicting results, and therefore the suffik is the tension created between the two. So I just wanted to add on to that description of what suffik is, just in etymological evidence to that idea, which is that the word suffik, really I should preface this, that the fact that the word suffik is not really a biblical word, it's really a rabbinical word. The word suffik, there is no word in the Torah for doubt. You say this is the idea. So there's some who explain that the language of Lashon HaKodesh, the language of the Torah, is the language of reality. It's the language we say that Histakel Bo Reiso Bar Alma, the Kadosh Baruch Hu looked in the Torah, and with that he created the world. That the Torah is really the blueprint of creation. It's the spiritual reality based on which physical reality is built. And Safik Mi Ika Sveika Kape Shmaya, that there's no such thing as a Safik in reality, there's no such thing as Safik in a Kadosh Baruch Hu's perspective, meaning that there's no reality to a suffik. A suffik is not something real. A suffik is something that's only from our perspective, from our lack of understanding, but a suffik is not intrinsically real. And it goes a step further, that is the idea that really the only reality of existence, the only true reality of existence, is the existence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and really there is no room for the suffik of the ultimate suffik of the question of my existence being separate from Hashem's existence, is my seeing the possibility, imagining the possibility of existence without a Kadosh Baruch Hu. There's no room for that suffik. The reality of existence is that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is the totality of existence, and mimela comes in, that the idea is that miika sveika klape shmaya, that there's no such thing as a suffik, and therefore there's no word in the Torah for suffik because it's not real. So that's but that notwithstanding, the idea, the word that Chazal use for a doubt is a suffik. The word suffik has the same letters and the same shoresh as the word sapek or sapak. The word sapak has a couple meanings in Chumash, all of which are in Tanakh, which are very conceptually related, but the word the word sapek can mean a collision, like v'sapek moav b'kio in Yirmiyah, in Perek Mem Ches of Yirmiyah, which means that moav collided with its own unfortunate results, whatever it means, collided with themselves or with their own byproduct. But either way, but the idea is that it means a collision. That's the idea. It's two things colliding into each other. It's two opposing forces coming into contact and creating some kind of reaction of tension. Of what is, so that's what a safek is. It's the same idea. And the other thing that a safek, that sapak means, is like vayispok es kapov in Bamidbar Chaf Dalid. That means to clap, to smack his hands together, to clap your hands, is also sapak, like the expression for which means clapping hands. But sapika, I don't remember. But in any case, the sapak means to clap the hands, and the same idea is the two opposing elements coming together and crashing together in a way which creates a clash, which creates in a way which creates a tension, the force that oppose each other, and that's what creates the sound, is the crash of the two opposing forces coming together, right? And that's, and really, you know, specifically by clapping, it's kind of ideal expression, the right and the left, which are the two fundamental opposites in Jewish thought. The right and the left often represent two diametric opposites in how Kadosh Baruch Hu runs the world, the diametric opposites of Rachamim and Din, or Tov and Ra, and all these kinds of things. That the collision of those two things coming together is called Sapak, and that's the same idea as a Safek, is the consequences of two opposing implications, or two opposing factors with conflicting implications. That's what a safek is. And the simcha, we mentioned last week, we developed the idea that simcha is the resolution of safek, is creating the harmony, is synthesizing these two aspects and seeing how they fit together and resolving the issue. That's the ultimate simcha, is the resolution of conflict. That was the idea we developed last week. I'm not going to go back into that, but I just wanted to add on that point about the idea of what suffix is and where you see really in the language itself expressed this idea that's the idea of suffix. So we discussed for the past 2 weeks the idea of tekiya, teka, b'shofar. We discussed the teka part, and we developed a number of ideas that are very interrelated, which all express the idea of a tekiya, which we basically described as that summed up most aptly, most succinctly, in the sound of the tekiya, which is one long, straight, uninterrupted sound, which is that the idea of a tekiya is where everything fits together, everything is part of one unit, everything is one solid, interrupted sound. That was the idea of a tekiya, is the harmony, everything fitting together, everything being one piece. So now tonight I want to discuss shofar. We're going to discuss what the word shofar really, what it means and what it represents. And then I don't know if we're going to get to it tonight, but we're going to try and explain what is shofar gadol. Right? Seemingly, obviously, does not mean that it's a large shofar, that it's, you know, very big and heavy and long or whatever it is. In what aspect it is great? What aspect the shofar is gadol, and what that means? And maybe say gadol in comparison to what? And also that it's lecheirusenu, that we're blowing this shofar for our cheirus, for our freedom. That exactly what the freedom is that's being described, and how the shofar and the tekiya shofar ties in to that idea based on the approach that we've been developing. But let's go slowly, one step at a time. So first we'll start with shofar. So to understand the concept behind shofar, like we often do, we're going to try and just go through the meaning of the word based on just the Hebrew language. We'll start with that. Rav Hirsch, in a number of places, but maybe most at length, in Brachos Mem Tes Chaf Aleph. So the brachos, Yaakov is giving the brachos to the Shvatim, and he gives the bracha to, make sure I don't mix up names here, so I'll just open the pasuk, gives the bracha to, I think it's, already passed it. Here we go. It is to Asher. Not to Asher, to Naphtali. Naphtali says, Naphtali Shmeina Lachmo, Naphtali Ayala Shalucha, Hanosein Imre Shafer. That Naphtali is a speedy deer or gazelle. Who's sent in Nosin Imre Shafer, who gives Imre, who says over Imre Shafer, he says over pleasant or beautiful sayings. So Rav Hirsch describes that there are really, I'm going to kind of expand and embellish what he says, but the basic idea is based on the description of the words of Rav Hirsch there. Rav Hirsch says that there are really two kinds of beauty. The word Yofi, Yafeh, from Yofi. Yofi is beauty according to how it strikes the beholder, meaning it's projected beauty. It is the sense of beauty and how it excites the senses. Yofi is that which elicits your senses, which creates a sense of excitement. It evokes a sensual response. That's the beauty of Yofi. Yofi is the source of attraction. It's that which leaves an impression. Yofi is the impact that it has on a person. It's how the beauty affects a person. That's what Yofi is. When we talk about, you know, someone being physically attractive, so generally we're talking about Yofi, something being strikingly beautiful. Generally, they're talking about the Yofi of that object. And the word Yofi is related to the word Moface. Moface, it's in an overwhelming appearance. A moface means a wonder, a sign, something which is performed that you see, which overwhelms you, which, you know, strikes you a certain way because it's an incredible sight. So that's the way that something impacts you and affects your senses, the way that it hits you. That's what Yofi is. Also, the Yofi related to the word Hofia, which is the Shoresh of Yafa, Yud Pei Ayin. The same idea. Hofia means the way something is presented or emerges, how it reaches you. That's the idea of Yofi, is the way the beauty reaches you, the way that the appearance of something impacts you in a positive, exciting, illicit full way is that's the Yofi of something. And the other type of beauty, which is being described in the pasuk here, in the verse here in Bereishis, is Shefer. Shefer, the verse says, is the beauty of harmonious conformation. It's the beauty of everything fitting together. When you see Shefer, the reaction that you have is that it somehow feels right. It all fits together. That looks like it should be there. Everything looks like it fits. That's, you know, you sometimes you hear a song, right? By Naphtali, that it was Imre Shefer. You hear a song, and it's just the notes, like that was, you know, like it's hard that you can't really rigorously, you know, explain it, but it just, that's the way that should have been. They got that song right. They got that poem right. They expressed that, you know, the right way. It wasn't something that was, you know, exciting. It just, it somehow clicked, it fit together, everything, you know, fell into place, and that was the way that thing should be. That's Shefer, when everything fits together. There's an expression in the Gemara, in Aramaic, when they're, you know, the Gemara is presenting a machlokas, there's two opinions, and the Gemara will bring a braisa to some Tanaic source to support one side or the other, something which seems to work well with one opinion and seems to be problematic for the other. So the Gemara will say, Rava Shapir. It says, according to Rava, this is Shapir. Shapir means this. It fits. Everything fits together. It's fine. It all works out. That's what the word Shapir, the same word Shefer, is the idea that something, it makes sense. It fits together. Everything falls into place. Everything fits in. That's the Gemara's expression is that it's Shapir. A Shafruer, There's a word in Tanakh which means a rounded pavilion. It's something where it's an arched structure built around one central guiding point. Is the same conceptual idea of that everything is tied together, everything fits, is built around one central structure, everything is fits into the design. It's all the idea of Sefer. Hirsch relates the word Sefer to Sefer. There's a certain way in which he does it. I'm going to try and express it a little bit differently. But that he talks about the act of sphere of counting. But we'll get there in a second. A Sefer is a recollection, a recounting of events that fall under one theme and form one idea. So, for example, each Sefer of Chumash is split into five Sfarim of Sefer Bereishis. Chumash, Bereishis, Sefer Bereishis is one theme, the theme of the creation of the world, and the theme of the beginnings, the beginning of the world, the beginning of Klal Yisrael. And then you have the book of Shmos, each, and Chazal gave each Sefer of Chumash a name which encapsulated the theme of that Sefer, but all that Sefer has one unifying theme which ties everything together. And then the entire Torah is also called a Sefer. The Sefer is all the Sefer Torah is also one broader theme, is all of the expression of Ratzon Hashem. That's the unifying theme of the Sefer Torah, is every word in it is the Divrei HaKadosh Baruch Hu expressed to Moshe Mipi Gvura, is the expression of Ratzon Hashem, is the one unifying theme of that Sefer. And each Sefer of Navi has some idea that defines what that Sefer is, that unifies everything under that theme. That's the idea of a Sefer, is a collection of events which all fall under one theme, which are being tied together. Same thing, a Sipur, which is a story. A story is putting together events into one central plot. It has a beginning, it has a development, it has a climax, it has a resolution. It's one central plot which ties everything together. A haphazard jumble of events and unrelated tangents and things that just seem to veer off and then come back and whatever it is not a Sipur. That's not a Sipur. That's a rambling monologue. I don't know. I don't think there's a Hebrew word, but that's not a Sipur. And it's not Sefer. It's not harmonious. If you listen, you're listening to something like that. In fact, it's very frustrating to listen to that kind of story. You're left hanging. You're kind of like, you don't understand how everything fits together. You don't understand why this. Well, what did that have to do with anything? It's all tangled and jumbled, and that's the opposite of Sefer. A Sefer and a Sipur ties together all of the parts and has a resolution. I think for this reason that it's emphasized that even though Esther is a Megillah, that it's emphasized, it has halachic ramifications, the fact that that Esther is also called a Sefer, because Esther, you read it superficially, and for sure, as you go through it, it's hard to see, how everything fits together. As you're going along, it's very, it's kind of, different things happening, you don't understand whatever, but you get to the end of it, and all of a sudden, you see everything come together, and you see that Esther is a Sefer. It's something where everything is united under one central theme, under one idea with one theme and a resolution in which everything works out, everything fits together. That is the idea of a Sefer, is the same idea of Sefer, of being harmonious, of everything fitting together. The idea of Sfira, of counting, I'll talk about the conceptual idea of what counting is. Counting, the most basic idea of counting is you're grouping elements that share a commonality under one conception. If you think about it, a number is really a concept in which you have grouped a number of elements. If I tell you to imagine four apples, so you might in your head picture four apples. If I ask you to imagine 437 apples, so you do not picture in your head 437 apples. In order to picture that many apples, you would take you basically have to count to 437 and imagine each apple as you added it in, and then try and keep track of how many apples you had in your mind. Well, it would be basically impossible. It's impractical and almost unfeasible. When I ask you to imagine 437 apples, 437 becomes a concept, becomes a bookmark, a marker representing a concept of a certain quantity. Normally, I think most people probably above the number 6. Probably starting from 7 or 8 would stop imagining the actual, picturing a number, will stop picturing the actual number of objects, and we'll just start replacing it with the concept of 43 apples. 43 will be a concept that represents that number of apples, and I'll understand that 43 is a concept which is more than 42 and less than 44. But it's just a marker that represents the concept. And I know when if I come to translate that into a reality, I'll know to count out 43 things. But as a concept, it's really not. When I imagine 42 and then I imagine 43, I don't imagine what I imagined by 42 and then add in one more apple in my mind. I just increase the number of the concept. The number is just a marker. The number itself becomes in my head just a concept which is uniting these items which have now, in a certain sense, lost their individual identity. I don't think of 43 individual apples. I just think of a concept of 43, which I know represents, and I know what concept that number represents. And that's the same idea that counting is grouping a number of elements under one concept. I've basically taken these items and I've identified them and united them under this concept of the number. I think this is along these lines. I heard a similar explanation. I'm going to change it a little bit to fit exactly the way we're saying it, but that's possible. You could explain along these lines why it is usher to count Jews, and why, when David HaMelech did a census and he counted Jews, why the result was a plague. When you count a number of objects, when you count, you know, 4 cows, so those 4 cows are all, you know, there in individual. When you get to a high enough number, like what we're explaining, all of a sudden you no longer have individual cows, or individual apples, or individual people. You now just have a group of people which have lost their individuality, which have no existence as individual elements. They're just part of, they're just one contributing factor to this broader concept, which I'm going to describe in my head as 43, right? If there are 43 people, I don't have 43 individuals, each of whom is being represented. They're just all globbed together into a concept now called 43. When you count something, you strip it of its individuality and you say that it's just part of one, you know, bigger glob. And therefore, it's usher to count Jews, it's forbidden to count Jews, because you're saying, you're expressing that they're all the same, right? That they all go together, it doesn't matter who's who, it's all just one, you know, one big blob of humanity, and there's no individual significance to each one. And the result, when David HaMelech conducted a census, the result of the consequence of a census was a plague, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, if Jews are all the same, then I don't need so many of the same. So they're dispensable, and that's the result of the plague. And that's the HaKadosh Baruch Hu counts Klal Yisrael to show their chavivus, because when HaKadosh Baruch Hu counts, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can appreciate the individual element of each one while still performing a count. For HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's not a problem. Therefore, to show how he's keeping track of exactly how many there are, because each one is precious, for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that makes sense. But for us, when we count something, the only way our mind is capable of dealing with a number that large is by reducing the elements into just something which loses its individuality and becomes just represented under the broader concept, and it does not have an individual representation of its specific and unique existence. That's the idea of Sphira, is also this idea of bringing everything together, unifying everything together under one central concept, is the same idea of Sefer, of Sipur, of Shefer, of Shapir. It's everything. You're taking all of the elements and unifying them and creating one harmonious existence out of this group. And that's the idea of the beauty of Shefer, is the beauty of harmony, of seeing that everything just fits together, everything has its place, and everything makes sense, and it just, if there's a harmony, there's a balance to it. That's the beauty of Shefer. So we talked about in the past couple weeks, we made a list of our ideas of all the things that fit with Tekiah, the idea of the one long sound, which basically where everything is part of one picture. We talked about Rachamim fits into that concept, that Din is the result of taking things in a vacuum, but Rachamim is the result of looking at the big picture, seeing everything as part of a bigger picture and seeing things in context. We talked about the idea of Malchus, that the idea of the Melech is that he takes the individual elements of a nation and he combines them into something new. He makes them from a ragtag group of individuals into a nation, able to capitalize and actualize their potential in a way that they are not able to do as individuals, able to direct and create a new entity. Is the same idea of taking a group and putting it together into one new entity, which works together, which is unified. So all these ideas, and last week we talked about Simcha. Simcha is the same idea, is the resolution of doubt, is taking two opposing elements, two things which seem to contradict each other, and making harmony out of them. It's fitting the sides together. And we talked about the idea of the Beis Hamikdash being the place where you really synchronize and synthesize the physicality and spirituality, and the idea of harmony, of fitting everything together. So the most recent addition to our list, the shofar from the Lashon of Shefer, right? Shofar is also that which brings harmony. And the blowing of the shofar is something which we'll discuss exactly how this is manifest. The blowing of the shofar is also something which brings about a harmony, brings about a unity and a balance that is that's represented by the blowing of the shofar. So we'll discuss where the shofar shows up, where we find the shofar, where it manifests, and what exactly is the harmony that it brings, and we'll try and tie that into the idea of Cheirus and exactly what's going on with Tekash B'Shofar Gadol L'Cheirusenu. And I think that will be next week's discussion. Maybe we'll start this week. But first, just before we move on, just a word, you know, talking about shofar, it would be hard to ignore Rosh Hashanah, and just to explain how this ties in very neatly to Rosh Hashanah, that on Rosh Hashanah, the mitzvah hayom is to blow the shofar. That's the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah. And we blow the shofar in order to be mekabel ol malchus shemayim. Blowing the shofar is part of the act of malchus. We talk about we mentioned this actually the past couple weeks, that when they anointed a king, they would blow a shofar. And the idea of tekiyas shofar represents is part of kabbalas ol malchus, part of accepting the king. So, just to explain this concept, how blowing the shofar is the expression of accepting the malchus of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we discussed this concept in our introduction to Bar Yeich Aleinu, and we mentioned this medrash, but just to rehash it here, because it fits the very significant element to what we're discussing, is a medrash says that there was a nation that they wanted someone to take charge of them, to become their king. So they approached him, they said, make laws for us. Make laws for us, we want you to be our lawmaker. And the person responded very intelligently, says that he replies, first accept me as your king, first accept my malchus, accept that I am the sovereign, and only then can I make laws that have any meaning. Only then, he says, first accept my malchus, and then I'll make laws for you. First you have to be mekabel me as the Melech. First, you have to accept that I am in charge, and then I'll make laws. But if I make laws, but you haven't yet accepted that I'm king, that I am basically have the authority to make laws, and my laws are what are accepted by you, whether you like them or not. If you just tell me to start making laws, so as soon as we get to the first law that you don't like, so that's going to be the end of me. That's going to be the end of my tenure here. Is that you've basically instructed me to make laws, but you haven't accepted that the general construct, the general system in which my laws are binding, which my laws are which in which I am the Melech. So that's the Medrash compares is really what happens with the Kabbalas O Malchus and Kabbalas O Mitzvos, that first you have to accept the Kadosh Baruch Hu as being king. That's the Shema Yisrael Shem Elokeinu Shem Echad is one of the psukim of Malchus, right? That it's accepting the yoke of a Kadosh Baruch Hu as being in charge, as being one, as being the only power, as being Elokeinu. And then only after that can we have the Kabbalas Ol Mitzos, that first, that Ol Malchus Shemayim, the idea of accepting HaKadosh Baruch Hu as king, of being Mekabel Ol Malchus Shemayim, accepting the Malchus, is the accepting, it's the underlying acceptance of Hashem's authority and His ability, and his authority and ability to be mitzaveh, his authority and ability to issue decrees and commands, on which all mitzvos are based. All mitzvos are predicated on that acceptance, that first we're accepting that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one in charge, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who has the right to make the rules, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who has the right to dictate where my life should be going and to tell me how I should be living my life. And only after that do we have the individual mitzvos. Only after that is there a point, is there a goal to the individual mitzvos. And in this way, I think this is why, if you count, we say we have Aseres Yimei Tshuva, but if you count them up, you really only end up with, you know, 8 or 9, depending on when we talk about the Arayis and the Rabbanon, but we really only end up with 8, because on Rosh Hashanah, there's no Vidoy, there's no Slichos, there's no Tshuva, seemingly, on Rosh Hashanah. So how do we have 10 days of Tshuva? Where does Rosh Hashanah seemingly counted as one of the Aseres Yimei Tshuva? Where's the Tshuva on Rosh Hashanah? The Rosh Hashanah is the premise of all Tshuva, returning to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. First, if you want to go on a destination, if you want to get somewhere, first you have to set your sights. First, you have to calibrate that you're going in the right direction. The first thing you have to do is Kabbalas O Malchus. You have to accept, in the broader sense, that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is the one in charge, that he has the right to decree and decide and determine where my life should be at and how I should live my life. That's the first step. First, you have to turn yourself in the right direction, and then you can start going, and then you can talk about returning to that ideal. But first, you have to have the ideal. First, you have to have the Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shemayim. So, Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shemayim is the acceptance in potential of all of the mitzvos that follow. Is the role on Rosh Hashanah, which is also Rav Yonasan Eibshitz talks about this, that we find that in certain places that they blew, in Beis Din, they blew a shofar, or they blew a blast to issue a cherem, which was a decree of din upon someone. You're declaring judgment upon someone. So on Rosh Hashanah, we blow the shofar, and we say that when we blow the shofar, it moves the Kadosh Baruch Hu mikisei adin to kisei rachamim, from the throne of judgment to the throne of mercy. So Rav Yonasan and Eibshitz asks, how is it that this, which is, you know, seems to be an invocation of din, is going to be used to move a Kadosh Baruch Hu from din to rachamim? And he says the difference is that when Beis Din blows this blast, they're doing it regarding someone else. They're invoking din on someone else. But when we blow the shofar, we're invoking din on ourselves. When you are saying, Kadosh Baruch Hu, come and judge me, You are declaring a Kadosh Baruch Hu, you are the one who has the right to make the din. It's that I'm held responsible to your standard. That's the declaration we're saying by invoking din on ourselves. That is the ultimate declaration of Kabbalah's Ol Malchus Shemayim. We're accepting a Kadosh Baruch Hu, that we are responsible to your standards. And that's the real accomplishment of Shofar, is this acceptance of Kabbalah's Ol Malchus Shemayim. So this ties in very nicely to what we're talking about, that the blowing of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is very, very much appropriate for the shofar, for the role of the shofar. Shofar brings together, it unites the details of our specific mitzvos and our Avodas Hashem into one central unified concept of Ol Malchus Shemayim, that Hashem is in charge. It's the unifying all of the details, all of the specifics, the Taryag Mitzvos, everything which is very practiced, very detailed and individual, uniting it under one construct of the underlying predicate of mitzvos, of that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in charge. That's what the shofar does, is it creates that unifying underlying factor which unites all the mitzvos and puts them into one harmonious construct of Ol Malchus Shemayim, of that Ratzon Hashem is a binding Ratzon, and that's the role of shofar. The Chol Makom is to create a harmony, to bring things together, to unite everything into an underlying unifying concept. Same thing on Rosh Hashanah, that's what the shofar is accomplishing. Next week, we will discuss why it's a shofar double, and why it is what it means that the shofar creates chayrus. So we'll pick up on that next week.